Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi from Brand Positive, a research, foresight, and strategy consultancy for corporates, agencies, and NGOs. I've spent 20 years working on catalytic projects around the world, and along the way have been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom are guests in this series, along with an array of other fascinating individuals. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, focused on innovation. My next book will focus on foresight. So, I hope you enjoy this podcast, which is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, a global leader in applying futures thinking to solve strategic challenges within organisations. But now, let me introduce today's guest. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Adam Hamielowski. He is the co-founder at Starling Strategy, a specialist cultural insight and brand strategy practice who've been running for about 7 years. They're strategy partners for clients including Google, Nike, PepsiCo, Pan Macmillan, the National Trust and others. He's worked in insights and brand strategy for close to 25 years. Early career was spent as a researcher and ethnographer for leading qual agencies like Flamingo, where he explored the everyday lives of people in places like the kitchens of Moldova, the streets of Delhi, and the bars of Warsaw. He's also a lecturer on cultural strategy at the University of Bristol's School of Management, where he focuses on the theory, in particular drawing on Doug Holt's work, translating into practice. His brilliant partner, Annie Auerbach, is also an author of the fantastic book Flex and an expert on the future of work. Finally, Adam is currently undertaking an MRes at the Cabot Institute for the Environment, exploring how brands construct sustainability campaigns as cultural strategies using myth, promoting ideologies, reconfiguring systems, and more. So, Adam, hi, how are you? And apologies if I rather mispronounced your name.
No, you don't have to apologise. I'm long gone from worrying about how people pronounce it. Don't worry. But it's lovely to be here, Sean. And been looking forward to talking with you for a long time, actually. It feels like our paths haven't crossed, but we've been in the same orbits, maybe.
Yeah, precisely, exactly. So I know a bunch of the same people and all the rest of it. So yeah. That's actually fantastic. And yeah, equally looking forward to the conversation. To start somewhere, and there's a ton to get through because you're up to such interesting things. But go on, the usual thing. So there you were at Oxford, and after that, where did it lead you?
Thinking back, because as you said in your intro, it's been 25 years now since that era, which is God, quarter of a century. We can worry about that one for ages. So it led me nowhere for a while. But then I saw, I can actually remember this quite vividly, advert for a business which was called Market Behavior Limited. It doesn't exist anymore, like a lot of research agencies that have been swallowed up by bigger ones. But their pitch was for someone, or their ask was for someone who loved understanding what made humans tick and loved travel and had a language, which kind of, at least two of those, I think were true for me. And I went along and had a chat with a lovely guy called Nick Long, who still works in the industry. And I had absolutely no idea what I was getting myself into, what market research was, even what brands were, to be honest. But it sounded like a lovely gig of traveling around the world, trying to get under the skin of why people did stuff. And so that was how I got into it, massively by chance, I think you can sense. But it was for a long period, essentially what I did. So that, you know, qual research was my thing, international qual research from MBL, as was then, through to Flamingo. Really privileged to spend a lot of time. And this is pre financial crash. So, you know, a lot of lovely business trips on business travel and lovely hotels. And we can't pretend that wasn't a perk. Mm-hmm. but as you said, you know, from Delhi to Moldova to Moscow, Bangkok, just having a lovely insight into, you know, such variety of cultures, primarily through qual research, as I say, and It was from what was quite interesting, just reflecting on it a bit just before coming on here. I'd spent my degree researching history, which was taking a kind of sort of macro perspective, a longer view of, you know, a longer time frame to understand events, movements, and so on. And it was a leap into a much more psychological world, which I had no training in. And obviously it was a kind of training on the job. It's a much more kind of micro view of people's lives. And I don't think I really appreciated it at the time, that leap.
Yeah.
In many ways, actually, and we'll probably come on to this, I've kind of leapt back. I've leapt back to the more historical and what you might call a sociological view of how societies work rather than how what makes humans tick.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely fascinating. And while we'll talk about, I know one of these sort of key things you're looking at the moment, looking at what the FT covered fairly recently as a new global gen divide that's emerging, with Gen Z in particular being perhaps perceived as being two generations, not one. But before we get to that, perhaps just take us through, go on then, a couple of case histories, if you sort of can mention things that aren't too sort of confidential for the client roster you've got.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, probably more recent ones. As I say, what we do now, Starling, is not qualitative research, not consumer research, actually in the conventional sense, as you might predominantly think about it. We are cultural insight specialists and strategists, meaning we'll take very often a historical view. When I explain what we do to friends who aren't in the industry, they'll kind of go, oh, you kind of look at cultural histories of ideas and peoples and social groups. And that's actually quite a good way of explaining it. Not the one I'd use with clients, actually. But we'll kind of put a longer time frame on issues. And that can be a word, a concept, an equity that is particularly pertinent to a brand. And so without connecting it to any particular case study or brand in itself, that can be things like community or play, or even childhood as a concept, as an idea. And we'll take those ideas and we'll kind of make those sorts of things which are quite familiar to people, and we'll make them strange, meaning we'll look at them with a different perspective, and that is very often a historical one or a cultural one, and we'll kind of map out how some of those ideas have evolved over time. So we might take play, for example, and you know, if it's a central theme to a brand, it's one of its core equities, say, we'll go, okay, well, let's look back at how play as an idea, particularly say around childhood, has evolved over time. And we'll do so with a view, I guess, to do a couple of things. One is to, the word might be problematize the current situation. So what might be some of the problems that the brand could effectively, well, first of all, see around the issue of play? And I don't know if you've looked into this, Sean, but
yeah.
Play and childhood, there's a number of things that it's such a fascinating history and topic, because so much of play in its kind of original form has been sort of squeezed out of childhood.
Yeah.
So we'll spend some time on the problem and dissecting and deconstructing different problems or tensions that might exist around the word and the topic, and then use that as a jumping off point for what a brand can do differently, whether it be through innovations, positioning, whatever the, you know, comms campaigns, whatever it might be that they're trying to do.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it slightly sounds paradoxical using history as a jumping off point for different ways to think about the future. I think that's quite good essence to what we do as a business across loads of different types of work.
No, absolutely fantastic. I mean, certainly that issue about play, isn't it? I mean, it's such an epic subject to get into. I've looked at that quite a lot over the years, and yeah, where do you stop? Sort of thing.
It's
yeah. 8 years later, and you're still sort of going, sort of delving into it, and obviously sort of in sort of whatever, you know, one always sort of looks at people like sort of, I don't know, Pat Kane with a sort of play ethic and all that sort of thing, and then lots of authors with surnames not unlike your own, actually, in terms of
the Pat Kane. I think Pat Kane's actually doing a follow-up to his play ethic book. which is really interesting. I can't remember what it's called, but and I think he's looking at a kind of with his huge brain in a sort of broader kind of policy making. You know, what can we learn from play that we can kind of remake the world a better place in all the different ways that we need it to be. So it's really interesting to me, and I don't actually know Pat. Love to chat to him, but why now? Because it's still clearly such a pertinent topic to need to kind of bring back into kind of public debate and consciousness. And it's got huge history, but clearly it's got loads of room to still go.
So meanwhile, in terms of, say, one of the things that you focus on in a big way, which I think is just so interesting, sort of, you know, quoting, if you like, quoting you back at you, as you mentioned, sort of, you know, alongside the brand activity that you do every year, you choose one topic that feels societally urgent, tricky, messy, and personally relevant, and you work on it also on a sort of pro bono basis. So go on then. What's the background to this year's choice, and what are you up to there?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a sort of slightly different a different way into doing work. The bread and butter, if you like, is us working to client briefs. But over the last couple of years, what Annie and I have done is just gone, well, you know what? One of the beauties of having your own business is that you can sort of set your agenda. And it took us a while to get there. But then, you know, what are the issues that through our work have come up, or just through, you know, the conversations that we have, that we think we can add something to the debate as a business, as a couple of people thinking about cultural change, social change, and this year we've done what we're calling the Rift, which is investigating the kind of ideological and sort of structural divisions that we're seeing open up between boys and girls, men and women, genders, in all different facets of society and life. The piece you referenced earlier, that many of your listeners will probably have picked up on a lot of the media, which has been detailing this. So the FT did the most prominent piece. John Byrne Murdoch, he does these amazing deep dives through data to illustrate sort of bigger cultural issues. Just looking at the kind of the shift or the division, the growing division in political ideology between men and women. Women typically, and it's not quite true of all cultures, but a lot of them shifting towards the liberal pole, and men not doing so as much, or shifting to become more conservative in their views. And we just found that kind of a theme, I guess, that has manifested just a lot in different types of work we've done. When we've looked in the world of sport, for example, there's a lot of work that's been done around how spaces have become dominated by boys. Boys is probably the wrong word, actually. It's probably more patriarchy. I'm a big believer in not making individuals responsible for stuff. So hence my shift there. But there's a brilliant group, for example, called Make Space for Girls. I'm not sure. I don't know if you heard of them. They're a charity, I think, a non-profit, who they've identified just across so many different facets of life, from playgrounds to sports facilities, just how little space, literal space for girls is afforded, is afforded to girls. So they've campaigned for how that can be made differently. So we'd seen this sort of issue crop up in lots of different ways, and we wanted to really get into the weeds of it, actually, and understand why this was happening and what the causes were. And that actually, and we're sort of midway through this whole process. I can't really say where we've ended up, because I don't know where we will end up. But one of the driving principles of this, and I think actually very much emblematic of what we do as a business at Starling. And actually what how I think personally is like is really deconstruct the historical roots of the problem.
Yeah.
Because only then really I think can you actually identify where you can intervene, where in the system, to call it that, you know, where in the kind of real weeds of the structures that you need to shift, or the ideas that the narratives you need to shift, where can you make a difference? So so we've been going through that with a set of different people that we're collaborating on. It's a collaborative project. So it's not just me and Annie. It's we've got a set of people that are different parts of the world applying their very smart brains and different lenses to things. So people looking at, for example, out in Indonesia, there's a wonderful agency called Nation. They are looking at kind of the aesthetics of this and how what you might call, I guess, the cultural marketplaces are evolving, and what is it, the language of some of these social media spaces that become very tribalistic.
Yep.
What is it that the what kind of narratives and ideologies and aesthetics are taking hold that make it in some way feel like they offer the different sexes, different genders, a sense of belonging or meaning or whatever.
Mm.
So it's not just a kind of political thing. I mentioned the FT thing. It's not just politics with a big P.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of cultural separation going on here, as well as just simple physical separation. I'm a big believer in contact theory. You know, the idea that, you know, it sounds so simple, it's so banal I explain it, but like the more contact, the more physical contact people have together, the more kind of they get along. I mean, it sounds so basic, isn't it?
There's a lot of talk, wasn't there? I mean, during COVID, one of the, obviously, the most obvious point there is that as per sort of Klaus Schwartz and Thierry Mallory talking a lot about the issues of just exactly that the lack of physical contact and what that meant in sort of cultural and social terms.
Yeah, no, and I think back to, on the pandemic, one of the things that stuck with me since then, in terms of, you know, trying to understand what's going on right at the beginning, I think it was Nicholas Christakis, I think, talking about how the metaphor or the analogy to war, you know, are we facing a war here, was not correct for a pathogen, because typically pandemics around pathogens make people fearful of each other.
Yep.
So it's not actually a kind of this sort of collective moment where everyone comes together, although there were bursts of that, of course. But it actually, the much more deeper rooted problem is this kind of fear of other people. And back to contact theory, you know, you see this at play in these really fraught debates around immigration and, you know, obviously the ones we're having here in the UK. Back to the rift, you know, just unpicking all the different aspects of what the problem might be, zero-sum thinking, the idea that particularly in economically turbulent times, one group will blame the other group for problems, or they'll see the other group as winning when they're losing, this kind of zero-sum mentality that grows. So yeah, we're going through that process and we're not quite sure where we end up, but we're super keen that in some way it moves the agenda forwards. And I appreciate it's such a big problem.
Mm.
Sometimes you can feel overawed by it.
Yeah.
But you know, whether we create some form of documentary, we're quite keen that this becomes a visual narrative. Hopefully that can be used perhaps particularly amongst young people in schools. But we'll see. We're working at how the different strands all come together. On that, actually, and this links to one of the problems that we're starting to see emerge. A brilliant professor, academic, Dr. Alice Evans, who you may have read or come across before.
Yep.
She's very much kind of focused, and she has been for a long time, around the gender divergence. And she used this phrase which really stuck with me. I think anything with the word culture in it often grabs my attention. But she used this phrase, cultural entrepreneurs.
Yeah, yeah.
To describe mainly people like Andrew Tate, who they will capitalize on issues, but, you know, resentment, senses of alienation amongst men.
Yep.
And they will entrepreneurially find ways to weaponize that for their for their own gain, and obviously, and also make money. Hence the word entrepreneur, and make money from it. And they're all and this is quite tricky to accept, I think, from the the left point of view, I think, is that they'll do it in a really entertaining way. And, you know, conspiracy theories, having looked at that a little bit over the time, you know, they're terrible things and they spread misinformation and they're really toxic, but they're also quite fun.
Yeah.
And they're quite entertaining.
Oh, very much so.
And and I think back to the word or that phrase cultural entrepreneurship, it just made me think, well, how can we create cultural entrepreneurship which is more bridging divides, or what would be the kind of positive cultural entrepreneur examples we can think of? Because, you know, stepping out of this topic, Steve Bannon, alongside Trump, I mean, he was fantastically clever in his strategic use of cultural entrepreneurship, tapping into places like gaming communities to stir up and ferment, you know, division from similar themes, actually. Long answer to your short question, but that's what we're getting ourselves into. And yeah, watch this space, see where it goes.
I mean, absolutely fascinating, as you're saying, with things like conspiracy theories and fake news and all the rest of it. You know, one thing they never are is boring. And so is that, obviously, it's the whole sort of you know, clickbait thing, isn't it, that they're always look over here, be it on a sort of dog whistle base or not. And yeah, certainly people like sort of Steve Bannon, one of the things about him is a brilliant speaker. And you know, famously, that piece he did at the Oxford Union whatever years ago, really, really compelling viewing. And before you sort of realize it, so you find yourself sort of like nodding along, and then suddenly it's like, hold on a minute, what did he just say? You know, sort of, you know, 5 out of 10 points seem so utterly reasonable, until you suddenly get to the locking people up and social division and pointing fingers and all the rest of it.
But, I completely can see it. There's a lovely phrase in Naomi Klein's latest book, Doppelganger, which I'm sort of dipping in and out of currently, where she'll say the right, often they'll get the facts wrong, but the feeling's right.
Oh, yeah, great line, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's just that really stuck with me. And we did, this is pre-COVID actually, so it wasn't to do with COVID at all, a lot of work around vaccine hesitancy. That's always been a fascinating case study for me as Starling. It's going back sort of 5 years now. And that was using cultural methods of analysis and output to complement what was a more kind of behavioral focus. And the kind of overall objective was, you know, how do we combat vaccine hesitancy amongst a particular group? So one time we're looking at mothers and MMR effectively. And another piece around older people, and getting the various jabs that they might need. And there one of the things we found was just the role that with mothers and a lot of the misinformation and conspiracy theories around autism and MMR, the media that they were using to spread these stories was just really effective and really entertaining. And the people doing so as well, you know, various celebrities. And in contrast, back to kind of Naomi Klein's separation of facts versus feelings, you had, you know, your major, this is in the US actually, so you had your major pharma businesses and brands just having a list of bullet points of why you should go and get your vaccines. And you're kind of like, well, there you go, there's one problem there. And it's storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. People saying that sort of thing of you find yourself turning up with a fact sheet to a knife fight, and it doesn't get down too well. Meanwhile, I mean, just another issue that obviously very, very closely linked to this in terms of yourselves is in terms of brands getting, or perhaps more worryingly, not getting culture the issue of wild overclaim and, as I think you, Pete, you put into Walk a while ago, about cultural parasites.
Yeah.
So go on then. What is it one, that one can look to when you're talking about brands that are getting it horribly wrong?
Well, it's a bit horribly wrong is the right phrase. It's a kind of maybe well-intentioned,
a more polite way of putting it.
Consequences that might not have been what people intended. So what I meant by cultural parasites, and there I am stealing a phrase. You can tell that's what I do for a living. Steal phrases from people I spend a bit of time with or read. Douglas Holt, who I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know, author of Cultural Strategy and tons of other great academic work and brand thinking. So he had this this watch out, I guess, of when brands do engage in culture, whether it be, you know, kind of working with different cultural ideologies or getting involved with different social issues and in different ways, that when a for-profit brand and a marketplace gets involved in things to, you know, take female empowerment, often what it will do is make what is happening on, say, the edges of society and culture and some of the kind of spikier, more radical versions of whatever the topic is, and it will kind of dilute them and it can water them down as a more kind of palatable version for a more mainstream audience that a brand can sort of, through its advertising, through its product, kind of claim some form of resonance with.
Yep.
And that actually, it's not just him, but plenty of people have talked about in the specific context of womanhood and the whole femvertising phenomenon, which was all about kind of taking what were, you know, obviously a kind of big social phenomenon movement, visualizing it and packaging up in kind of products or slogans around self-belief and empowerment and confidence, and, you know, that girls should show more of. And so it's that kind of idea that when brands do get involved in social and cultural issues, there's always a watch out. There's always a danger that through watering and diluting them down, it's not just making it more palatable for the marketplace, for the mainstream audience. It actually can detract from those political causes or those socio-political causes.
Yep.
You know, there is that kind of popular sort of idea, isn't there, that governments and politics aren't doing what they need to be doing for people. And that opens up a void or a vacuum for brands and businesses. You kind of hear that quite a lot, whether you're, you know, people are talking about the environment, sustainability or other kind of social issues. That's good and that's interesting as far as it goes, but I really do worry that ignores this kind of other aspect of what brands can do, which is draw the sting away from those projects of change through politics and citizen action, bring them into the brand sphere and not necessarily have the potency to actually affect change that they purport to do. And I'm sure, I mean, I think you've had John Alexander on here, haven't you?
Yeah, sure.
Citizen. So he'll talk about this in different ways, and he's obviously focusing on the citizens part rather than the consumer part. You know, I'm kind of interested in how the consumer element of this, or the brand element, can draw the sting, if you like, away from that some of the more potent marginal parts of culture and society, which I think they can absolutely work with them. It's about finding the way to do that and finding the kind of authentic and the right mechanisms with which to do it.
Yeah, and I saw it in the piece that you put out about it, Walk, talking about, you know, so therefore, you know, almost, you know, what is the, what are the sort of, like, the tick box list for actually how to have a healthier, more responsible relationship with culture? He's talking there about, you know, seeing culture as social and shared, and the work as structural, not just a sort of, you know, being done at a symbolic level, and also thinking about resistance, not just relevance. But just talk about that, the resistance, not relevance angle.
Yeah, the resistance is a it's a word that kind of came from a piece of work we did about a year ago where we applied the three horizons model.
Yep.
To a challenge, to a category, to understand where it'd been and where our client might take it. And I think we adapted it as these Scrum models tend to be adapted. They're probably, that's what they're designed to do. And the kind of horizon two model to mean the pockets of resistance in the present, which kind of open up space for the future. And these might be innovators or entrepreneurs who are trying to do things differently and nudge systems or categories in different directions. And we're so used to, when we think about brands and culture, the word, the phrase cultural relevance has become such a kind of a high watermark, or the standard thing that we're looking for. And I just think sometimes it's actually just better just to stop and slow down and just think, well, what are the people or groups or communities or interesting organizations that are trying to affect change, which I've kind of called the resistance? What are they trying to do? Because I think if we can just pause and slow down and look at those a bit more with a bit more scrutiny and attention, I think you're much more like, or less likely to do that parasite thing that I was mentioning. And the example, we've done loads of work in the outdoors, nature, different groups, organizations trying to broaden that out from being quite a male, white dominated space. And loads of interesting brands are doing wonderful things to kind of work in conjunction with, say, indigenous communities or people who have historically been locked out of kind of narratives and popular understandings of what the outdoor means to them. There's a great group I quote called Outdoor Afro, who promote exploration of nature from a Black perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just interested in looking at, you know, whatever fields you're looking at, how does a big mainstream brand work in ways that feel respectful to what they're trying to do as organizations? Because often what they're trying to do is, to use the kind of systems theory language, they're trying to change the goal of the whole system. They're not just trying to do something interesting. They're just trying to become part of the mainstream. They're actually trying to reset something, and it might be completely different to what the dominant category discourse might be.
Mm.
And that to me is really interesting, because how do you bring that into the mainstream, for want of a better phrase, without losing some of that energy and purity?
Yeah.
Even though it's very hard to just gatekeep or maintain that kind of purity. You know, ideas evolve as they travel, you know, as they become shared across people who aren't all the same.
Yep.
You've got to allow for some evolution of those ideas without losing them and having them diluted. And it's just a if I do a next phase of my academic, sort of part-time academic work, that might be the sort of topic I'd look at. I'm kind of really interested in how ideas travel, so that the futures that they're trying to create are the ones that they have in mind.
Yep.
There's just one little anecdote, or not anecdote, little nugget I read about people, I think it's in the sort of environmental space, who are looking to work more with kind of indigenous practices, which are more kind of sustainable sort of inherently in many ways in terms of design, technology and other things, that they are creating contracts, literal written contracts, whereby there is kind of a negotiation and a kind of written pact around ownership of certain ideas, correct attribution to who came up with them.
Yeah.
You know, and I just quite like the idea of entering into contracts with these people that you're trying to learn from and use their ideas when, you know, I'm not the first person to say that capitalism hasn't typically worked that way.
Very true. But also, just to finish that particular piece off, I thought it was really interesting that the sort of phrase you used in the piece you did for Walk, we should treat culture as we should nature. Such a great sort of a summarizing point there.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Just in terms of you saying being a sort of a fairly obsessive reader, go on then. Anything that you are or have been reading recently that you could particularly recommend?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I say, been dipping in and out of Naomi Klein's Doppelganger. I kind of find myself listening to people's podcasts alongside reading their book. I kind of found myself doing that more and more. I think it's probably because I'm cheating. I'm not sure, but I kind of love listening to their narrative around their book and then kind of getting back into the reading. But that's probably more a fair reflection of when you say reading. But yeah, so Naomi Klein, I've recently got into, again, probably quite late compared to others, Emma Dabberi, who writes beautifully about different parts of women's lives and bodies. And her latest book, which is called Disobedient Bodies, Reclaim Your Unruly Beauty, talking about beauty in many ways and women and how beauty is entangled in all, you know, all these forces of patriarchy and capitalism and gentrification and consumerism. And it's not anti-beauty. This is what I've kind of find really interesting about her work is, you know, she will talk about all the joy of beauty and the friendship and the experiences around different parts of beauty, but she will not hold back in scrutinizing the system underneath it and how it's, you know, corrosive in all sorts of ways. And she, I mentioned earlier about the focus of history to really kind of get to the roots of a problem. That's one of her kind of hallmarks of analysis, as it is with Naomi Klein, actually. You know, they'll both talk about it's far too easy for us to kind of blame people or point to people as, you know, the cause of this or that. And what we fail to recognize is the system underneath, which has caused the problems. It's back to the rift, actually. That's almost literally the kind of a core of the problem, that you've got people, genders kind of pointing fingers at each other as the causes of their misfortune. And actually it's very often the shared system underneath everything, which is the thing that's not being scrutinized enough.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember interviewing Wim Baptiste a while ago, fascinating individual, and he's that, again, that great quote, you know, the system isn't broken, it was built that way.
Yeah. Absolutely. My favourite on that similar line is more hopeful and optimistic, was the David Graeber quote, which I do want to get right. That's it. The ultimate hidden truth of the world is that it is something that we make and could just as easily make differently.
Such a great line, isn't it?
It's brilliant. And I think you probably find it odd that there's a brand strategist talking about it, because I think brand strategist is one of his bullshit jobs. he wasn't planning for people like myself to be using and applying it to our work, but still a lovely line, as you
exactly
say.
And it's fantastic that one does so. And then what about in terms of what you're up to at the moment, what's coming up for you with the consultancy?
We are looking to, I mentioned we do a lot of work in sports, and one of our, it's not unrelated to the Rift perhaps, but we are particularly interested in women's sport and sport for girls and the work that's required, I think, to really encourage the growth of a thriving and healthy culture around women's football.
Yeah.
It's come an awful long way. Actually, one of the books, you're talking about books, I've recently gotten very much enjoying is a book called Woman Up by Carrie Dunn, who is a brilliant analyst of women's football and has written loads of books about that. And this is, what's the subtitle? Pitches, Pay and Periods, The Progress and Potential of Women's Football. Mm. And back to my kind of, you can probably tell my recurring theme and interest is she's sort of going, you know, we've come an awful long way if you look historically compared to where women's football was.
Yep.
She tells a story quite early on about how not very long ago at the World Cup final, women's football, I think it's about the 70s, the players had to go onto the pitch and pick up dog poo before it started.
Wow.
And yet, you know, look at where we are. Yesterday, I think the North London Derby, Spurs, Arsenal, there's something like 60,000 there.
Yeah.
I think Arsenal's average attendance is something like would be in the top 10 in the men's game, Premier League. But having said all that, it's the message is we have only just started.
Yeah.
You know, don't take any of that as an idea, the sense that we are, you know, this is it.
Mm.
And back to the kind of the systems part of this, and as she puts it, pitches, pay and periods, a lot of the next phase is less just sort of representation in the public eye, you know, that kind of, you know, I need to see it in order to be it. Not to that, you know, part of the job's done, but a lot of the next phase of work has to be more structural stuff. It has to be more, it's more hidden and less sexy stuff. Probably stuff doesn't easy translate into an ad, perhaps, I don't know. But it's kind of really working at the kind of, you know, how are women's, you know, bodies and physiognomy different, so that we need to think differently about training and coaching and uniforms and all the rest of it. Laying on provisions to get girls to play. Typically a lot of girls, teenagers would drop out of football around sort of GCSE type periods. And, you know, that's a particular pinch point. So, which feels a bit different to the boys' game. So how do we need to think about that differently? So we're looking to collaborate with a grassroots organisation actually around a piece of work there, which we're hoping to get off the ground, which would be brilliant, because I think a lot of thinking needs to be done. So it's not just women's football as a kind of sub-brand of men's football, or using men's football as the kind of enduring template of what good looks like.
Yes.
I think there's a ton that men's football could share, if you like, with women's football.
Yeah.
Shared resources and shared other kind of ways of bringing women's football forward. But I think I was chatting earlier about margins and mainstream. You know, what is it? What if we genuinely treated girls and women's football as a marginal culture, not just game, but culture, with its own values, its own world and aspirations and goals?
Yeah.
What actually are they? And what would we do collectively, men and women and everyone, to bring them forward?
How interesting.
So there's that. And other thing, I need to write a 30,000 word thesis by the end of the year. So
as one does,
yeah. that's the probably more daunting thing. I'm okay with like seemingly kind of massive one word briefs or the future of this, that, or the other in client work. You know, that apart from anything else, I've got my brilliant partner Annie to do it. You know, that's how I operate. Me speaking to you on my own here is quite a weird experience, because frankly it's quite rare for me to be doing that. But in my academic part-time life, that is what I'm doing. And it's, I think the dauntingness comes from that. But
Superb. Okay, well, in that case, just before we begin to finish off, and obviously it's been such an interesting conversation, Adam, so thank you so much for sharing the time. So, gone then, in terms of sort of key takeaway points, and perhaps answering almost the sort of the bluntest one in Socratic terms, which essentially is for all those brand sort of teams out there that one often hears are totally obsessed with the short term, why should they care in terms of culture and brands looking on that level?
Well, as you say, there is an obsession with the short term, but the short term can often provide what I read the other day. Someone used the phrase "wobbly data," and I think there is a sense of that perspective that you can get when you put you sort of reconnect brands back into a longer time frame. When you reconnect brands into a broader, I don't love the word context, but it sort of works for what I mean in terms of kind of, you know, we far too often think of brands disconnected from the kind of cultural and social world that they live in. We think of people far too disconnected as these sort of sovereign individuals who go around choosing things, and they have these things called behaviors, you know, or attitudes that, you know, there's very little sense of, okay, but where have they come from? And if we can connect that all back together, I think you get a much broader, bigger, and often much more exciting view of what's possible. I'm talking about Doug Holt's work. You know, that wasn't just a sort of academic exercise that he was trying to do. I think he was trying to get people more excited about the opportunity that you can see for changing things when you put a brand back into its cultural context and its cultural story. And that's often we find that with our client work, is that when we can put, I use the phrase often, history in the making. So when you can put a brand or an idea that a brand is particularly, you know, one of its distinctive assets, if you like.
Yeah.
If you can put it into that longer narrative of change, then it really opens up people's perspective to the future of, okay, I can see where we've been, I can see what the problem is now, and it really galvanizes people to have an optimistic sense of what the future can be, whether it be to change a category or to really champion an idea for its original roots of what it was supposed to mean and has perhaps lost its meaning. So all of those things and many more. I think the cultural case, or the case for brands in culture, keeps on growing. And that's something I'm really fascinated by following. So Helen Edwards, talking about margins and mainstream again, her great book that's come out recently, she'll talk about how, you know, culture, the things that are happening on the fringes and margins of culture and society can really help to reinvigorate what have become stagnant categories. And, you know, for economic reasons, there's a lot of stagnation going about. And back to your question, it can be very easy to focus on fixing the short-term issues. But, you know, her viewpoint is like, you know, you've got to lift your head and think about the innovation. You've got to think about, you know, building the brands off the back of ideas which have sort of a bigger cultural meaning and a longer term future, because ultimately that's what, you know, is going to galvanize action and kind of a sense of forward momentum again.
Superb stuff. Well, look, Adam, that's been absolutely brilliant. A really, really good, if you like, sort of a walk through a series of absolutely dynamic and sort of a catalytic perspectives. So, I mean, really all that leaves me to do is to say to Adam Hamielowski, co-founder at Starling Strategy, who believe in wild ideas and progressive futures, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Sean. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to The New Abnormal. This series is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, which helps clients become futures ready. Just so you know, the issues discussed in these podcasts also link to my speeches. Check out seanpeterc.com for more info. Please listen to previous conversations in the series with many other fascinating guests. But till next time, goodbye.